I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. With me today is Professor Ronald Sultana from the Department in Education Studies here at the University Faculty of Education. Professor Sultana is also founding director of EMCER, the Euro-Mediterranean Centre for Educational Research, which has the objectives of South-South and North-South dialogue in education, and through this to enhance the possibility of mutual understanding and cooperation among the people of the Mediterranean in various spheres of life. He's here today to talk about an EU project entitled CrossLife, which I think links in with the EMCER initiative in that it is about cultural dialogue. Welcome, Professor Sultana.
Thank you.
Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the CrossLife project, sort of how it came about.
Yes, CrossLife is basically the idea of Professor Anja Häkkinen from the University of Tampere in Finland. And it follows up on a number of her activities in the area of vocational education and training at a higher education level and the relationship between education and work and culture. She has a rather large network that meets every year, and as an outcome of this larger network, there was this idea of developing a master's and doctoral program which brings students from a number of different European countries, as well as their teachers, their tutors, in order to work together with a view to eventually setting up an Erasmus Mundus MA program. So there's a long history behind CrossLife. It's people who have met in other contexts and have done other projects together. But it is the brainchild of Anja, and there were five partner universities that joined this particular project. Well, there was, of course, the University of Malta, but then there was the Institute of Education in London, the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. There was the University of Monash in Australia. So the Australians actually joined us through funding that is made available by the EU for third countries. Not just from around the Mediterranean, but also, let's say, there's some funding for Canadians, and in this case, Australia. And in fact, Professor Terry Seddon was one of the a very, very active partner in this project, and added a great deal of value to the project. So we worked together very well, and we had a number of meetings. So the project basically was a trial run of what would eventually should have become, didn't, but should have become a master's project, which would also have involved some doctoral students. And the project had, in a sense, a five-step pathway. This is the way we refer to it, as a pathway, where we had a number of, we had two meetings between the tutors, where we planned our program of study for the students that would eventually join us. But we also had three workshops. One was in London, another was in Tampere, was held in Tampere in March, and the final one was held just last September, and that concluded the project that was held in Malta. So we had these workshops with different themes. And the project had a very special, in a sense, characteristic, which had, it was both content-oriented, as I said, trying to link, to find the links between education and the economy in what we're calling globalized times. So, you know, how is globalization affecting education and work? And how is globalization affecting the relationship between education and work?
In fact, one of the statements that I came across in the description of CrossLife, it says that the CrossLife collaboration creates a cross-national space for research and research training focused on the changing relations between work and learning that are fundamental to the development of a knowledge-based economy and social cohesion and citizenship, and the contribution of education to these economic and social developments. That's sort of quite Euro-speak.
Yes, Euro-jargon, indeed.
Euro-jargon. For example, what exactly are these changing relations between work and learning?
A fundamental premise is that we are increasingly becoming a knowledge-based society and a knowledge-based economy. That is, work is being restructured in ways that demands and rewards workers who have high abilities, who are innovative, who are technologically literate, and who are flexible and adaptable and who keep on learning throughout their lives. So that's partly the jargon also we associate with a lifelong learning society. Of course, we also had a very critical take on this, because we do know that despite all the rhetoric around lifelong learning, what we see is that while there are some areas which are knowledge-rich in the economy, that is work that demands more and more skills and more knowledge, in fact, probably the fastest growing area is knowledge poor areas. For example, takeaway restaurants or fast food, you know, this kind. And it is not necessarily true that we find an upskilling of work. We either find a reskilling of work, but sometimes also deskilling of work. That is, workers are actually putting less skills into their work than before. This is extremely important, of course, and we're trying to see also how the rhetoric of lifelong learning the discourse around lifelong learning is being generated. Why is it that we're pushing so many students to go on getting on degrees and higher diplomas? And there's a fair amount of research which shows that these graduates are heading for disappointment and disillusionment, because they're going to be either underemployed, that is, they're going to be employed in jobs which require less skills than they have obtained through their education and training, or else they have to just simply switch to other jobs despite the fact that they have been trained for a particular sector. So the linkages between education and work are complex. Although there is what we call even an education gospel nowadays, that basically it's almost a moral imperative on everybody to learn more and more and keep on learning and to be flexible throughout life. We need to question why there is this rhetoric, whose interests is it serving, and whether we are representing social life truthfully. And these are some of the issues that we looked into within this project.
One of the things that comes across from what I was doing a bit of background reading, obviously, for this interview, that CrossLife was interested in looking at the idea of how things are done in different cultural milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps I can make a sort of polemic remark, if you like, is it really necessary or even desirable that we should be looking to develop practices or promote policies in our multicultural societies, because we're not just talking about, if we're talking about Europe, we're not just talking about the different countries of the European Union, we're talking about many different cultures within each of those countries. So sort of multicultural approach is a very complex one. And in that statement that I read before, we were talking about social cohesion, citizenship. I mean, what's going on here? Are we trying to sort of develop educational practices across the board, or are you sort of looking at the different cultures and seeing how they can be looked at in different ways?
One of the aspirations of the European Union is actually to create, as we know, mobility of goods and mobility of persons. And that one way of facilitating that is to create a common European education space, which means that basically people who are studying in Malta can go abroad and study and continue with their studies overseas in the EU European education space. Their credits are acknowledged and recognized. And academics can also move between one university and the next, or one vocational institution and the next. So there is this idea of creating this European education and research space, and there's quite a lot of funding being pumped into this particular goal. Now, what we did with our project, which I think was innovative and challenging and interesting, not just for us, but there's a lot of learning for the European Commission here in relation to its international projects. We had a focus on content, as we have been talking, you know, describing earlier. So we did focus on content, and we did focus on developing courses, which we then taught through workshops with students from several countries. But we were also very, very interested in process. What happens when you get academics from different countries to contribute and to co-teach a course, to co-plan a course? What happens to the students who are coming from different countries when they actually join the workshop? In fact, we're not only interested in culture in terms of national cultures, we problematize that. I mean, what does a nation mean? What is a national culture? We know that, as you said, within each national boundary, there's so many cultures, other cultures. But we also took culture within its broader meaning. So we looked at gender cultures. What does it actually mean to have men and women working together, collaborating on producing coursework, course outlines, teaching together? What are the implications for having people from different generations? Okay, older, established academics, and younger ones who are, on their way. So we also talked about what we called an academic apprenticeship and how that works. And also culture in terms of disciplinary cultures, which we don't often talk about, because we tend to think of university as a whole. But in fact, a lot of the conflict and a lot of the confrontations that arise within universities are not traceable back to simply personalities. Of course, there will always be that. But it's also linked to how we do our work as sociologists or as natural scientists, as biologists or physicians. And we looked at how difficult it is actually to talk across academic disciplines, to do multi and interdisciplinary work, because we have different assumptions about what counts as knowledge, how to achieve that knowledge, the methodologies to be used. We have very, very different notions of the importance of language in all this. So we had major clashes within our group where those of us from the social scientists kept talking and talking about discursive issues. You know, this, we're trying to unpack discourse. For us, discourse is extremely important. It's a way of creating, constructing a world in a way. While the physicians and those who came from mathematical sciences just wanted to cut through all that and just get to the point and possibly present it as a formula, which, of course, got us into a lot of trouble.
Yes, I can imagine that. It's interesting that you should have been experimenting within your own group, the problems that you were actually then actually discussing within the project itself.
Yes, in fact, what we did was we actually kept diaries. We kept diaries of our meeting, of our email correspondence, we also used Skype in order to minimize costs and travel costs and all that. But we did keep a very critical eye open on all these proceedings. And in fact, I actually co-authored a paper on this, looking at the issues, the cross-cultural issues that arose in cross-life. And for most of us, this probably was the most interesting. And at the end of the project, we shared this with students because we wanted to show students that coming up with a course, organizing a course, and co-teaching a course is not as simple as it looks. There are so many processes that need to be disentangled and to be critically commented on.
In fact, before we move on to talk a little bit more perhaps about the analysis of what you were doing, I'd like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm speaking to Professor Ronald Sultana. So, Professor, you were saying about how you sort of put across what happened to you to the students. How did you do that exactly?
Well, we used a particular methodology called critical incident methodology, which is basically we looked at some of our meetings between the tutors that were organizing and delivering the course, and each one of us tried to find an incident that was particularly meaningful, which disturbed us, which made us, you know, become angry, which made us feel that we were, you know, really living on different planets, or that we could actually work together despite all the difficulties. So we, each of us identified a critical incident. We agreed on certain ethical principles as to confidentiality and all that, and we wrote this up. It was my task and that of a colleague of mine from the fifth university, which I did not mention, the University of Zurich, Catherine Krauss. We co-wrote this paper, looking at the critical incidents that our colleagues had highlighted. We tried to see what was going on here, what could be attributed to power struggles within the group, what could be attributed to culture, and so on and so forth. So some very important issues arose. For example, was the assumption by UK participants that we were all equally proficient in English, and that, you know, they zoomed through what they had to say at a very fast pace, not, you know, bothering to or not being sensitive to the fact that some words others did not understand, or that some people could not be as elegant and graceful in articulating complex thinking in a language which was not theirs, and that some people feel stupid because they haven't mastered the language, and they feel very frustrated because they have important things to say, but cannot say it, cannot articulate it through English. So that was a very important issue, which made us all realize how language silences others. So too was gender. I mean, there were instances where some of us males just assumed, you know, that we could talk away without being sensitive to the way our logic and our mode of rationality was silencing other modes of logic and rationality, which are, let's say, if we agree that there are women's ways of knowing and male ways of knowing, we were not terribly sensitive to that. There were also occasional comments made, for example, about Malta as a small island, which irked some of us in Malta because there was, you know, it was all with humor, but it was insensitive, especially coming, you know, for people coming from larger countries. Or comments about, let's say, the state of the roads, you know, the usual typical things, which we wanted to make people aware that, you know, there are sensitivities around that that they weren't aware of. And so on and so forth. I mean, I remember a clear issue we had with the English was that they have a very complex quality assurance process at the Institute of Education in London, which basically takes ages accept an external professor as a professor, or that his or her courses are at master's level. The Finns, we in Malta, were much more flexible. We knew that people had published, we recognized them as professors, and we just moved on. But basically what they were telling us, we have to test whether you're really, you know, up to our level.
They're often used, I suppose they feel that they are used as benchmarks as far as standards are concerned, and they always feel that they are the top of that benchmark.
They often are not, but the point is that
perception is everything.
That their perception of themselves is such, and I think it's largely linked to a merchant mentality, which is they want to sell their education. So they are very careful who to let in. This is not being nasty to the group that was involved, because they were extremely nice people, but it's about we were talking about cultures, about institutional cultures. You have some cultures which are exclusive, and some cultures which are institutional cultures, university cultures, are very inclusive and very willing to accept other professors from other universities as having, you know, something to offer. Now, this is crucial, because if we're talking about a European space and about mobility of academics and mobility of students, then these issues are hardly ever spoken about, because they're awkward. they are rather awkward to talk about. But we're assuming in the EU that, you know, we're building this European education space and that we have all this exchange and mobility between universities. And we have found that this is not always the case.
I think that this is a good example of how a project such as yours is effective as research within research, and that this idea of the European community, which is often spoken about, perhaps is not such a reality, or certainly isn't going to be an automatic reality. I mean, we can perhaps talk about some of the problems of a project of this nature, but this surely is perhaps one of the positive sides, that it does give at least the opportunity for people to discover and bring out into the open these kinds of realities.
Exactly, yes. And again, I mean, our project was even more complicated and complex because one of the universities, which is the one in Copenhagen, had students from its Erasmus Mundus program joining us, which means that we had people from Vietnam, from Hong Kong, Canadians, Taiwanese. And again, this was quite important because what they were telling us, well, here is the EU developing a program which is very much in the spirit of Fulbright, the American Fulbright. We all know what's behind Erasmus Mundus, which is attracting the best brains from other countries towards Europe, which is also ethically problematic, but that's an issue. But what was of concern to us was that these students were telling us Europe is not open to these cultures. There is an assumption that we fit in. There is an assumption that as a Vietnamese I fit into the European mold in terms of how to think, how to study, what to do, how to interact, you know. So for the people involved in the Erasmus Mundus project, which is eventually what we're aspiring to develop, they were basically telling us, before you engage in cross-cultural learning and before you start inviting people from other countries and other cultures to join your course, make sure that you are aware of the cultural issues. And they need not necessarily be Vietnamese from Vietnam. They could be Vietnamese third-generation Europeans, as you would find in France, for example. So culture is an immensely complex phenomenon, having a variety of layers. And for us, it was an important learning curve. It was an important learning journey, which is why we called it a pathway in many ways, where, for example, we had students at the London workshop standing up and saying, this will not do. Now, for the Maltese, there were four Maltese with us in London, they were just astounded that students stand up and say, this will not do. They were challenging our pedagogy, challenging the course outline, challenging everything. So for the Maltese...
steep learning curve.
It was. They said, well, what we would normally have done in Malta would have been to go in the canteen, grumble, but smile at the lecturers and go on. And they just... For them, it was extremely awkward to see these young master students facing up their professor and saying, this is not on.
As far as deliverables are concerned with this project, what were they in the beginning and what did they end up being at the end?
There were a number of deliverables. I mean, there's the usual academic output. So we had three books kind of linked to this project, which grew out of this project, each one linked to each of the three workshops we had in London, Malta, and Tampere. So we have, when you publish three books out of a two-year project, that's usually considered to be excellent. So we did have these three books. These three books served as course material. So if we ever had to offer the course content again, then those books, which are of course valuable in their own right, could also be used as course readers. We also had the course outlines. That took quite a lot of work. For example, one major theme was focused on how ideas and policies in education travel. why is something that is, you know, attractive in the UK and is adopted as a policy in the UK, how does this and why does it travel to other countries? Are there colonial or post-colonial links, as with the, as with Malta? Is the UK particularly good at exporting its educational reforms, which I think it is, even though those reforms are not necessarily of any use educationally, but they do tend to travel very, very fast. What happens to these policies when they are taken up in another country? Are they shaped in different ways? Are they modified to fit a culture? Do they last? We ask questions like, why do we tend to also adopt a policy that has proven to be ineffective elsewhere? Why do we take it on? And why does, for example, a country like Germany, whose dual system, that is a system which has very successful in Germany, trained skilled workers by having young students spend a large amount of time in enterprise and a very short time in schools, why is it that this German dual system is constantly promoted elsewhere, even though most of the research tells us it will not work outside Germany for historical and cultural reasons? And why do the Germans push it? And of course there are very interesting answers. Germans tend to push this because with their dual model come German technicians, German companies, German machinery, which go into vet schools, vocational schools, and along with the dual systems comes the German Development Bank, and it's a way of making sure that they get a foot in developing countries. So we're asking these, again, awkward questions as to why policies travel.
Thank you very, very much, Professor Ronald Sultana, for coming to talk to us about your project CrossLife. I know that we could spend another program talking about all these issues, but our time is up today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Patricia.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.